This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
You've gone deep, man. You've gone so deep. It's rare that somebody is like literally like thought about something like this more than I have, but I've met him and his name is Dan. Hey there, listeners, future callers, and cooking enthusiasts. This is Dinner SOS, the show where we help you save dinner, or whatever you're cooking. I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious. And today, I am joined by Dan Pashman. You might recognize Dan's voice and iconic laugh from his work hosting the Sporkful podcast. Or you might know him from the pasta shape he developed, Cascatelli, which was one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2021. Later in the show, Dan and I will answer some listener questions. But first, I wanted to talk pasta. You know, most of the time I kind of come in here and I just wing it, you know? But with you, I was like, oh, I need to do some research here. I got to get the lay of the land.
I'm very honored.
Yeah, I ate Cascatelli.
Great.
Which I hadn't done before. Like, I'd seen it.
Right.
But I don't know. It wasn't necessarily stocked everywhere that I might buy pasta. But the other day, it was in a local market in Bantam, Connecticut. I think it was priced just under $5.
Okay.
I had just listened to most of Mission Impossible and loved the background on it. You know, just how much effort it took for you to bring that into the world. And I thought it was really good.
Thank you.
Legit.
Yeah, I mean, there were so many ups and downs in the process of making it. And the initial impulse was really more like, I want to tell an epic story on the Sporkful podcast. And then it was like, what if I invent a food? Mm-hmm. I remember saying to my producer, Emma, at certain points, we just need it to go either really well or really poorly. And either one of those will make for a good story. The fact that it ended up going really well was sort of some combination of grit and luck, I think.
No, and it really, honestly, for everyone out there, it's really fun listen, because it turns out that inventing your own pasta shape isn't as, does it sound easy? I don't know. Well, spoiler alert, it's not easy. And it's good. I mean, no less an authority than my 11-year-old son said it was the best pasta he had ever had.
Wow.
You know, I don't know that he was speaking hyperbolically. Like, I think he might have been onto something from the standpoint of he's a kid who prefers his pasta just with butter and salt. And I think Sfoglini pasta tastes, there is like an almost exaggerated quality to just like the flavor of the pasta itself, like that slightly nutty, earthy undertone that even if you are eating it just with butter and salt, you are getting a lot out of it. And certainly from a textural standpoint too, Cascatelli is not like any other pasta.
I'm a huge texture eater. You know, so maybe your son and I have something in common. So like I wanted, to me, like a lot of pasta shapes have kind of a dull texture that's a little bit boring. I have these three metrics that I use to judge all pasta shapes, which I talk about in the series. You know, forkability, which is how well does it stay on the fork, sauceability, how well does the sauce adhere to it, and tooth sinkability, which is how satisfying is it to sink your teeth into it. And I think a lot of pasta shapes maybe get one or two out of those three. Very few nail all three. And I wanted to nail all three. And Cascatelli's got these ruffles. I felt like a lot more pasta shapes should have ruffles.
Yeah.
They're just kind of fun and playful in your mouth. They're a different type of texture. But you're right, even with butter and salt, it's just like it's chewy and there's different thicknesses. And like it just, this was the luck part, Chris, which is that like there are different thicknesses around in different parts of the shape. And that could very easily go off the rails and you could have a wagon wheels type situation where the shape never cooks evenly.
Sucks.
But the fact that the difference in thicknesses is just subtle enough to be perceptible without cooking unevenly is incredible. And I can't take any credit for that. That was just good luck.
We all need a little bit of that sometimes. Yeah. Well, now you're doubling down in the pasta space and you're coming out with a book, Anything's Possible.
Yep.
Tell me more.
So, yeah, this was, in some ways, this is sort of like the sequel to Cascatelli. You know, and we've done a multi-part series on the Sporkful podcast about the behind-the-scenes story of the making of this cookbook that also features my wife and kids expressing a lot of doubts about the merits of this project. But yeah, so when Cascatelli came out, it was incredible. It went viral and I was getting all this attention. It was very exciting and gratifying. And people were sending me pictures of what they were making with it, which I'm sure for you is something you've experienced for many years. But I'm not a chef. I'm not a recipe developer. So I had never like made any food thing that a lot of people all over the country were all eating and messaging me about. It's very exciting and also kind of gratifying. And you almost feel like you're being invited to everyone's home for dinner. It's sort of surprisingly intimate to know that all these people are cooking your food in their homes. So it was really special. But there was one problem, which was that the overwhelming majority of the pictures people were sending me were Cascatelli with tomato sauce, meat sauce, mac and cheese, a few party animals made pesto. And like that was 90-95% of what I throw in cacio e pepe and carbonara, and that was almost all of it.
That's it.
And it just made me feel a little sad. And it also just made me realize that despite all of the different ways you can eat pasta, I think that for a lot of Americans, they're still working from a pretty limited palate. So I set out to make a cookbook that would show people that there are so many more things they can and should be putting on pasta. There's no recipe in this cookbook for marinara sauce. Marinara sauce is very good, but the world doesn't need another recipe for it. There's no recipe for typical bolognese or lasagna or standard issue cacio e pepe. I just feel like I love all those things, but again, I don't have anything to add to that discussion. So
most people don't respect that, you know, impulse. You know what I mean? I think like everybody's often tempted to nonetheless sort of develop into a very crowded space, you know, to put their individual spin on it. So I was really struck by that when I saw some of the concepts.
I appreciate that. I mean, yeah, I guess that's kind of my personality for better or worse. I'm sort of like allergic to doing whatever everyone else is doing. Mm-hmm. But anyway, point is, yes. So I was sort of like willfully stubborn in this cookbook.
I have to say, though, it's interesting that you don't describe yourself as a recipe developer. And maybe you see yourself differently now that you've undertaken, you know, a book, which is a huge lift when it comes from a recipe developing standpoint. When I saw some of the concepts, I thought they were very much in line with how, like, a modern, forward-thinking recipe developer would tackle pasta. You know, and if I can call out some examples here, shells with miso butter and scallions, cacio e pepe with chili crisp.
And optional Sichuan peppercorns.
There you go. Larb-ish cascatelli, shakshuka and shells. And I think we engage in that work a lot as, you know, a food brand, as recipe developers, taking something that's familiar but giving it a spin. So people can kind of understand what's happening in these dishes implicitly based on these descriptions. But clearly you are, I don't know, you're hijacking the flavor profiles a little bit, right? Like you're employing ingredients that might not normally fit neatly within that context that, you know, these dishes might have originally come from.
For sure. And I guess my brain is very analytical. And so when I look at a food, even though I'm not a trained chef, I tend to kind of like break it down into its component parts, which may be what you do also. So for instance, I didn't want to have a recipe for bolognese in my cookbook, but there are a lot of incredible dishes all over the world that involve seasoned ground meat.
Right.
So to me, any one of those is just a prime candidate for a mashup with bolognese. So we did a keema bolognese with Indian spices. So I think it helps that I look at food that way. But I also need to shout out the recipe developers that I worked with on my cookbook. And I, because I don't have that kind of experience, I made a point of really going out and hiring just an all-star team of folks. So I don't know if you know Asha Loopy. She's from Head to Table on Instagram.
Yes.
She is so talented. She developed a bunch of the recipes. James Park Irene Yu, who do a lot of Korean-American and Korean cooking. They did a lot of the Korean-style dishes and some of the, James wrote a whole book about chili crisps. So anything that's got chili crisp in it. In my cookbook, I worked with James on, and Katie Laird, who we refer to as Super Nona. She's based in Martha's Vineyard, but she lived and cooked in Italy. So she's sort of our connection to Italian roots. She lived in Puglia and was familiar with a few sort of obscure pasta dishes that I hadn't heard of before that we brought into the book. I couldn't have done it without them. And I made a point doing something that you don't often see in cookbooks, which is that I credited the recipe developer on each recipe because I just felt their work was so integral and they were really collaborators. There were some recipes that I was like, hey, here's an idea, and let them run with it. But there were some that they were pitching to me. And so I wanted to make sure they were getting a lot of credit because they took the book to the next level.
Is there any pasta dish that you just categorically don't like?
Ooh. I mean, I don't like angel hair as a shape.
That's fair.
So if you're going to put any pasta dish on angel hair, I'm not going to like. Bow ties and wagon wheels, no. Fusilli, no. Those are bad shapes. I don't love primavera.
Fair enough.
To tell you, I sort of feel like if it was marketed as a pasta salad, Mm-hmm. I think that I would accept it.
It's like a cold
more.
Noodle dish almost.
Yes, or serve at room temperature at a barbecue with some nice, you know, summer squash. I can see that. But like as an entree, it feels like the vegetables are too big in relation to the pasta. The sizes don't work for me somehow.
Yeah. Interesting. Haven't thought about that dish for a while.
Do you have one?
I know I want to tread carefully because I know you just entered this space with a wheat alternative pasta. I have a hard time with pastas made from things other than wheat. I think like there's just almost like the space of like functional pasta. It's like pasta plus protein, whether it's chickpea or lentil. I don't know. Anything other than kind of whole wheat or maybe spelt, I start to just be like, this is doing something different for me. I'd rather have like chickpeas and pasta together.
Right.
And maybe it's 80% chickpeas, but I get some pasta that just does what I want pasta to do. But I don't know. But if my kids ate it, would I make them, you know, bonza mac and cheese? Yeah, I probably would.
Right.
You know? Right. And my wife is gluten-free anyway, so half the time I'm like, I have to make unsauced pasta for one kid, sauced pasta for the other kid. I'm making brown rice jovial pasta for my wife anyway.
Right.
I don't even know what to eat anymore. It's like, it's not even about me. Right. Like, you know, that's where I am.
Right. No. There is a bonza version of cascatelli. And we did a whole episode of The Sporkful about sort of the science of gluten-free pasta. And even the scientists we spoke to in Italy, where a lot of the best gluten-free pasta is being made, even she told us, she's like, look, it's come a long way. And it's a lot better than it was 5 years ago. But no one's going to tell you that they're interchangeable. Like, if you can eat regular pasta, and you're going to be able to taste the difference.
For sure. Yeah. Let me throw you curveball. Okay.
I'm ready.
You're ready? Okay. So I had this idea like years ago, and you having undertaken the extreme work of bringing a new pasta shape into the world, my idea isn't so much for a shape. This would only work for like wide tubular pasta. Imagine ridges on both sides, meaning like ridges inside the pasta as well as outside, where you have decent assurance of like sauce penetration of like the inside of the pasta, you know, just because it would be like a wide tube, a mezza manicha, paccheri, rigatoni at the very least. But imagine you're doing ridges inside and out.
I think that's a really good idea. And now I'm curious to look, because I'd be shocked if no one's done that, but it makes a lot of sense because anytime you're increasing surface area,
yeah,
you're going to increase the sauceability. You're making it more tactile. It's going to hold things better. So by increasing the surface area inside the tube, more sauce should stay inside there.
Should. And it's a wide tube, so you're going to, you know, things are going to flow through it as well as around it anyway, generally speaking.
I like that, Chris.
Yeah, not bad.
And I like that you're talking about the big tubes like rigatoni, mezza manicha, paccheri, because I don't love the medium-sized tubes. Penne, ziti, no.
They're fine.
Right. But to me, the other problem with those tubes is that they are not wide enough to really flatten into two distinct layers and be incredibly satisfying like a rigatoni. But they're not narrow enough to spring back against bite force like a bucatini.
Mm.
They're just springy enough to spring off your fork.
Yeah. No, there's a certain rigidity to their structure that kind of defies easy collapse. And anyway, well, okay, I'm heartened that you don't think it's a terrible idea.
I think it's got a lot of potential to it.
So, Mr. Cascatelli himself thinks my pasta has potential. Sfoglini, DiCecco, Barilla, heck, Rusticella d'Abruzzo. Hit me up. I'm waiting for your call. We're going to take a quick break, but stick around to hear Dan and I tackle some of your listener questions. Hey listeners, Chris Morocco here. If you find yourself in a dinner crisis, the Epicurious app comes to the rescue. Not only will you unlock over 50,000 recipes from Bon Appetit and Epicurious, but you'll also receive daily personalized recommendations based on your unique preferences and dietary needs. Head to the Apple App Store and download the Epicurious app to kickstart your 7-day free trial today. Don't miss out on this culinary adventure. Start your free trial and let the Epicurious app be your kitchen hero. Happy cooking. Okay, Dan, we're back. So if it's okay with you, I'm going to pivot to some listener questions. All right?
Let's do it.
And just jump in. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. So the first one came as a voice memo from listener Matthew, and I'm going to have Michelle play that for us.
Hey, how's it going? My name is Matthew Gonzalez, or Sergeant Gonzalez. I'm with the United States Army here. I'm really curious. I was talking to my friend yesterday about kind of like a pasta dish. I've cooked many things. I grill, you know, I pan fry a lot, I oven bake. However, I just never have done much of a pasta. I don't know much about it. So I wanted to cook for the entire office and stuff like that. So I'm just curious on like recommendations for good, not a beginner pasta, because I know a good amount of cooking, but I'm willing to challenge myself.
I feel like you found my target audience here, Chris.
Yeah, totally. We did a very careful pull from the mailbag questions. Where my head goes with this is pasta for a crowd is actually hard, depending on what you're doing. Some of the best pastas in the world, I think, exist ideally on a very small scale. Like in cacio e pepe, it's hard to manipulate a full pound of spaghetti in a skillet and get the motion you need to emulsify the cheese into the sauce, you know? Whereas like where my brain goes with this is like baked pasta as a way of feeding a lot of people, but as a distinct goal that is separate from like learning about pasta. What does this do for you?
I agree with that. And pasta for a crowd can be a challenge, you're right. And I made a point of highlighting all the recipes in my cookbook that work for make ahead, and also to do specific instructions for techniques for like cooking the pasta in advance, maybe a minute short, lay it on a sheet pan to let it cool. And then you can finish the dish kind of at the last minute. So that opens up some possibilities where you want fresh cooked pasta, but you don't want to be starting from scratch when your company's there. But I agree, baked pasta dishes. But even that is an area where there's a lot of opportunity for innovation and new ideas, I felt. So I did a baked cauliflower mac and cheese. It's got like a mustard beer cheese sauce.
Actual beer in it?
Yes.
Yeah.
With like a Ritz cracker crumb topping. We did a, you know the movie Big Night? They did the
course,
giant,
the timpano.
Right. Yeah. So we did one of those, but a vegetarian one. It's not quite so unwieldy. But that's a bit sort
but
of...
with dough, a dough casing?
We did an eggplant, thin-sliced eggplant, roasted it with breadcrumbs, and then molded the eggplant around the outside to create this sort of like...
It's like a very deep quiche. It's like a bottomless quiche. Yeah. I don't know.
We did with pasta and mozzarella and cubed eggplant mixed in.
Yeah.
So that's really good.
Fun.
I'm trying to think of, you know what we did that's really fun is we took manicotti, or what's the other pasta shape that's like manicotti?
Cannelloni.
Cannelloni, thank you. It's like a long, giant tube, and we did like enchilada style. So we did smoked cheddar and shredded chicken. This one, you go to the store and buy a rotisserie chicken if you want a shortcut, shred it, mix it with some like sour cream or crema and smoked cheddar cheese, and you stuff the pasta shells.
Oh.
You stuff the manicotti, and you lay that out, and you cover it with cheese and enchilada sauce, and you bake it. And that's the kind of thing that you can make. You can prep ahead, throw it in the oven, and pull it out when everyone's coming, and you can make it for a crowd.
You get the store-bought manicotti. Okay.
Yep,
wow.
Yep.
Oh, fun.
Another one that we did that's fun for a crowd is a spinach artichoke dip lasagna pinwheels.
Wow.
So I have this feeling, I'm kind of anti-lasagna, Chris, because I feel like...
Okay, well, so there's another one.
It's great for a crowd, but it's like, it's a ton of work. And you kind of, the second it gets cut up and a few bites are taken out of it, you're kind of dealing with a baked ziti.
Effectively, yeah.
Right? Like, it all gets mixed up. So you put in all this work to create these beautiful, distinct layers that very quickly get destroyed. So I didn't want to have that in my cookbook. But I said, if there's going to be any kind of lasagna-ish thing, I want it to be something really special that a baked ziti format couldn't replicate. So we did pinwheels. So you lay out, you cook and then lay flat a strip of lasagna, and then you stuff it with spinach artichokes. We did like a lemon bechamel, and you roll it up, and you stand them up, and then you can cover them with some cheese, and it looks incredible. It's a total showstopper. It's also kind of like not quite as heavy as a lasagna. It's vegetarian, and it's got some cheese, but not pounds and pounds of it. So it's like satisfying and delicious, but also a little bit bright, and you say spinach artichoke dip to people, and they go crazy.
Honestly, that's a great example of like recipe development is full of hard choices. Like, you know, I've developed lasagna recipes. They all involve some amount of compromise, because the true ultimate example of lasagna is a phenomenal amount of work. I mean, handmade pasta, thin sheets, a long cooked meat sauce. To me, like what lasagna is all about, and this is why I get irate when I see a lasagna recipe that doesn't contain it. It's about the joy of bechamel in a baked pasta. You know, bechamel to me, it's like it provides like just like that moisture, that plushness that can contrast with like another sauce, like a meat or a tomato-based sauce. It's wonderful on its own. It doesn't break under the heat of the oven the way other cream-based pastas can. I friggin' love it. You know, like lasagna to me is about making some sort of love letter to bechamel. However you handle the question of, well, are you getting store-bought noodles or homemade? Are you doing a fast sauce, slow sauce, whatever else?
Right.
Well, I'd say like to Matthew, those are all great ideas from Dan's book. I would also just say like, listen, there's the pasta you want to feed a crowd, but then there's the pasta that I think can kind of teach you about what it truly means to, you know, fuse sauce and pasta together. I would highly recommend something like a cacio e pepe just for to make for yourself, just right on the side. Don't overthink it. It's a handful of ingredients and it will unlock a world of just the simplicity and the beauty of simple pasta-based dishes. Really building up a sauce out of almost nothing, creating an emulsion out of, you know, very little, but creating this like stable, wonderful, cheesy, rich sauce. Like that is something you owe it to yourself to get into.
100%.
That's an order. All right, next question.
Sergeant.
Our next question comes from listener Serena. I want to make a shrimp scampi pasta recipe, which calls for dry white wine, and I only have a sweet Moscato on hand. Man, I wish we could have been with you in real time on this one. I'm very curious which way you went with this. Will this totally ruin the recipe? How interchangeable are wines and other alcohols in cooking? Well, yeah, I mean, sweet Moscato, I'd say probably not, but mainly just because like residual sugar is not going to cook out of wine. You know, I think a lot of like why we cook with wine is usually for its acidity as well as some amount of flavor that kind of carries through in the final dish. But sweetness isn't going to go anywhere. You will have made your pasta, your shrimp, whatever it is, quite sweet at that point. The only thing you could at that point do is take a page from Jamesy's cookbook and throw some chili crisp in there, make it really hot, make it very bright. You know, that's how I'm thinking about that. Any thoughts?
I agree. I'm actually curious to get your take, Chris, because certain wines that people don't consider to be very dry, like a Pinot Grigio, but I feel like sometimes if I have a half drank bottle of Pinot Grigio in the fridge and I need to cook with some wine, I'll still use that. And that seems to work fine.
Totally.
So I think people shouldn't get too hung up when the recipe says a very dry white wine. Like, yes, it shouldn't be like sugar wine.
Right.
But like if it's Pinot Grigio, not Chardonnay, that will still be okay.
100%. Yeah, I'm very non-fussy about like what wine I might cook with. Whatever I have open is going to win every time, even if it's like rosé. You know what I mean? Something that's like a little like softer, maybe not quite as high acid. I'll still use it because what am I going to do? Like open an entire other bottle just to like then dump a third of it into a dish? No, right. It's not how I roll.
Right.
We're going to take another break. When we get back, more listener questions.
From the creators of Who Smarted, Starglow Media, comes a brand new podcast called Mysteries About True Histories.
Does that sound serious enough?
Max, we only have 30 seconds for this promo. Just tell them how your mysterious aunt recruited us into a secret order of problem solvers who travel time and have epic adventures.
I don't have to. You just did.
Catch new episodes of Mysteries About True Histories every Thursday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Dinner SOS. Our next question comes from listener Barack. Okay, this is a good one. With formerly cheap cuts like flank steak becoming more expensive, what proteins or cuts do you think are still great value? This one's hilarious to me because Inez, who does a lot of our grocery shopping here in the test kitchen, she was literally down at Florence Prime Meat Market like just a matter of weeks ago. Wonderful little neighborhood butcher in like Greenwich Village, West Village area. And like somebody was complaining about the cost of skirt steak. And the butcher was like, well, you know, these magazines, they keep writing about it and calling for it in their recipes. And now it's like $18, you know, $24 a pound, whatever it is.
So it's your fault, Chris.
Yeah, and she's just like, you know, like kind of like head bowed, ducking, backing out of the store. You know, call me crazy. I freaking love ground meat, quality ground meat. You know, if you have a place that actually grinds their meat on site and might even like incorporate some different cuts into it, some places, and this is more of like a premium butcher thing, they might even have like some amount of dry aged meat that might go into a specific blend. Honestly, you're gonna struggle to pay more than like 10 or 12 bucks a pound, you know, unless you're getting something super high end and specialty. And it's so versatile from a culinary perspective. That's kind of where I go, but that is more reflective of how I kind of cook at home. It's very rare that we're making steak just because everyone's such a pain in, at home. Right. Yeah, I don't know right. what to tell you, you know?
Right, right. No, I agree. Ground meat is delicious. One recipe in the cookbook that if you want to sort of like double your protein, Andrea Nguyen did a recipe a few years back for mapo tofu spaghetti. Mm-hmm. I worked with her to adapt that to go with cascatelli with my pasta because mm-hmm. the ground meat in there goes into those ridges and it's fantastic. But one of Andrea's strokes of genius in that recipe is that rather than taking a more firm tofu and cubing it in the mapo tofu, she takes silken tofu and has you puree it.
Oh.
Which gives the sauce the texture of a thick cream sauce, but with no dairy.
Yeah.
And it holds it all together. And so it's got a ton of protein, and that's not expensive at all. And it's incredibly delicious. But also, like you say protein, I think of chickpeas.
Yeah.
One of my favorite dishes in the cookbook is called chicharrì in tria. It's from Puglia, which is in the southeastern corner of the heel of the boot of Italy. And all the way down, you got to go to this city. It's like the southeasternmost corner of Italy, a city called Lecce, in an area called the Salento.
Yeah.
And Lecce is, like, even if you haven't been to Italy, I'm sure you've heard of Rome and Florence and Venice and Milan and Tuscany and the Amalfi Coast. Lecce is not near any of those places.
No, it's not.
The Salento has very little groundwater, so the cuisine there is very focused on legumes. They have very little meat and very little cheese. And they have this dish called chicharrì in tria. Basically, you take pappardelle, wide, flat, fresh pasta, and tear it into pieces like the size of sticks of gum. And half of the pasta you fry until it's crispy. And then you make a chickpea broth with a few basic vegetables. Mine has some white wine in it and chickpeas. And then the other half of the pasta you cook in the chickpea broth. Then at the last second, you add the crispy fried pasta. It is so simple.
Wow.
I mean, you know, this dish, you can make one portion of this for probably 50 cents. But it's got a ton of flavor, and it's got the protein of the chickpeas, and importantly, it has the two different textures of pasta, the crispy fried pasta and the chewy, doughy, fresh pasta, and it is so, so good.
Wow. I mean, I obviously know of, like, pasta chichi, but this is a variation of that that is very interesting sounding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, there's a bit of a debate in Lecce about whether you should take the fried
There's a little bit of a debate. No, Italians?
I know, you wouldn't believe it.
Disagree about food? Hold on, are you sure?
Yeah. So some people say you should take the fried pasta and simmer it in the chickpea broth for just 30 seconds before serving to soften it a bit and let it soak up some flavor. Others say no, serve the dish and then you put the fried pasta on top at the very end to maintain maximum crisp. I heard that this debate was happening, and I said, why not both?
Mm.
So for my recipe, I divide the pasta in thirds. So we have one third boiled, one third fried, and then partially boiled to maintain some crisp and different texture, and one third not boiled at all, only fried. And that creates three different pasta textures instead of two, which increases the textural variety of the dish and provides something that sensory scientists call dynamic contrast, which is a concept I'm sure you know well, of bringing together different textures into the same bite.
And now you are not welcome back in Lecce for the rest of your life. I hope it was worth it. Amazing. No, that's so cool. I often think about, I know we're like way off topic. I'm sorry, Barack. Like all you wanted was friggin' cheap steak and we're like
deep. He said protein. We got all kinds of cheap protein
for him. That's true. Cheap protein. I mean, obviously like going plant-based has like tons of merits behind it. But yeah, I think so much of this like regional variation from like one place to the next in Italy, it's like you could, you know, be from one place part of Italy and just not know what was happening like next door. That's just fascinating because I have family from the South and we never had anything like quite like that. Most of the food I grew up with was like influenced by American interpretations of Italian, Southern Italian foodways.
But, you know, if you really want to get sidetracked here, Chris, on something that I think you'll find interesting, my research trip across Italy, the most shocking thing, the big takeaway that really informed my approach to my book was that, first of all, Italian food culture is not as old as people think. Pasta culture is not as old as people think. Pasta has only really been the national dish of Italy for about the past 100 years. The carbonara was only invented in the 1940s and 50s, and the ingredients were only really standardized in about 2000.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as set in its ways as Italians themselves even seem to think. But also, a lot of Italian culinary history has been influenced by Italian Americans and by Italians going to America and then coming back during World War II. Carbonara probably could only have come to be because of the American presence in Italy during World War II and American rations that were sort of like bacon and eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And it had gricia, which was sort of like cacio e pepe, but with guanciale.
Guanciale, yeah.
So it was kind of like a pork and pepper and cheese kind of thing, but it didn't always have cheese. It was kind of a farmer dish, you know, a thrown together type of thing. And then when Americans were there and sort of eating bacon and eggs and having egg and bacon rations and stuff, that's the leading theory as to how it sort of got mashed up with ideas that were already there. And you ended up with carbonara, which has the eggs, the guanciale, and the pecorino and the black pepper. And so the point is that like Italian pasta history is not as old as people think. It's not as static as people think. And it's not exclusively Italian.
Sure, totally. Well, I hope you got all that, Barack. Ground meat, go to Italy.
Yeah.
And maybe some boneless short ribs in there.
Yeah, right.
Great, great affordable cut.
Yeah.
Maybe still passing under the radar. All right, finally, here's a seasonal question from Katie. My family and I love a lazy, lingering Sunday dinner. In the summer, we slice up fresh veggies, make or sometimes open some hummus, and pour on some briny olives. Maybe some burrata or feta jump on there if I have some. I feel like picking on the board all afternoon is so satisfying. Only one big dish to clean and you're done. But right now it's winter. The produce is not great. It's easy to be inspired when the weather is good and we want to eat al fresco, but the early darkness and chilly air is making it hard to feel inspired. My boards are more limp leftovers than magical mezze. What kind of winter board creations could you suggest? What do you think?
I mean, depending on where you live, certainly seasonality, there's times of the year that things aren't, you know, don't have as many options. But like, I feel like this is soup weather.
Mm.
And soup is another area where I feel like I think a lot of people are not taking advantage of the full spectrum of all the soups they could be having. But just like to me, I think something that would be in the spirit of what this person is talking about is like make a bowl of soup and then go to the bakery and get like a really nice loaf of fresh bread.
Mm.
With a nice thick crust on it. Maybe you're just dipping into the soup or maybe you're going to make some nice grilled cheese. I'm talking like griddled with a nice olive oil on the outside. Like you're going to cut thick slices from this fresh bread. You're going to griddle it in olive oil with maybe a blend of a couple different cheeses in there. And then you're going to dip that into the soup. That's like the wintertime version of what I'm hearing described in this al fresco scenario.
I like that. You know, there was many years where, you know, for Healthy-ish, which is a sub brand that we kind of had, Andy Baragani and I did a lot of the recipe development for it. You know, every year, January would roll around, we'd trot out the feel-good food plan. I loved those recipes. It was just non-dogmatically healthy, lighter approaches to just cooking, especially for people who are looking for a New Year's reset. The last couple of years, I've kind of been like, screw that. You know what I mean? Like, I don't. First of all, everybody else is in that space come New Year, right? Like, New Year.
Right.
Yeah, whatever. Fine. But like, yeah, eat the things that like winter is for.
Right.
Lean into the coziness, the heartiness. Lean into the fact that like, yeah, it's soup season. You know, you can bundle up with a bowl of like tomato soup or whatever and grilled cheese. I still think like, look, I mean like radicchio is in season. Maybe citrus and cheese doesn't always go together, but the firmer, saltier cheeses certainly go with citrus. Like, I think you just have to really shake up what you're thinking about, you know, as being like in season. Tropical fruit is in season. Again, I wouldn't necessarily serve, well, I was like starting to say like maybe not pineapple with burrata, but actually I think it might be a dish at
that could work.
Attaboy, you know, like in like one of their desserts. I think you're interpreting this a little bit overly narrowly, you know? There's a lot going on even right now. I love radicchio season. I love bitter greens. They last forever in the fridge, you know? The lettuce, I will agree, the lettuce sucks right now. It's like getting kicked all the way to the East Coast from California. You know, but the radicchio is perky. It's there for you. You know what I mean?
There you go. I got a recipe in the cookbook that's radicchio and endive with a sauce that's like a riff on like a bagna cauda. Like,
heavenly.
It's got like 18 anchovies. It's just like incredibly savory. And you kind of like sear the produce, sear the radicchio and the endive. And it's crunchy and it's bitter and it's incredibly savory.
Yeah, bagna cauda is like literally peak food in terms of like, you know, just something with tons of garlic, tons of anchovy, lots of olive oil, maybe a little bit of cheese in there, like something to dip your fresh veg, whatever in. You're not necessarily going to want to eat that in June, you know,
right.
Celebrate what's around like now that you can make the most of.
Right.
Well, listen, Dan, really fun to chat with you.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. I mean, my goodness, you've thought a lot about pasta.
Some might say too much, but, you know, I guess of all the things to obsess over in the world.
How is your family coping with it? Are they okay?
Well, I mean, they get a kick out of it. But, like, if you listen to the new Sporkful series about the making of the cookbook, which features them prominently, there are several hilarious moments where I'm, like, trying to explain to them the thought process behind a dish. I invented this thing called pasta pizza that's, like, you take a long, like, cooked fettuccine, put it on a sheet pan, and you roast it, and the bottom turns crispy brown.
Yeah.
And you get, whatever, you top it like a pizza, pick up slices and eat it. I thought of it while driving in the car, and I come home, and I said to my daughter, Emily, who's 10 years old, I said, I got this idea for this thing called pasta pizza. And she goes, oh, so like pizza, but like with pasta? I'm like, yeah. Do you want to hear more about it? She's like, no, it already sounds good. And if I ask you to tell me more about it, it's probably going to go into a whole long explanation. So I'd rather just avoid that.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I mean, it's worth pointing out that, you know, for people in the food space, their families are along for the ride, you know?
For sure.
Like, really.
Which, I mean, sometimes they get fed up. But when it's time to eat pasta, then they're on board.
If you have a dinner emergency on your hands, write to us at dinnersos@bonappetit.com or leave us a voice message at 212-286-SOS1. That's 212-286-7071. Check out Dan's book, Anything's Pastable, for more creative approaches to pasta. You can find it wherever books are sold. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating and review on your podcast app of choice and hit that follow button so you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening to Dinner SOS. I'm your host, Chris Morocco. My co-host this week is Dan Pashman. Our producer is Michelle O'Brien. Peyton Hayes is our associate producer. Cameron Foos is our assistant producer. Jake Loomis is our studio engineer. Amar Lal makes this episode. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. Next week, Izzy and Nina are twins who love to cook together. But while Izzy loves baking, it doesn't always go well for her sister.
I kind of just feel like I have like one more shot at trying to bake together and getting her to like it with me. And otherwise, maybe I'll just have to throw in the towel.
We were debating, should it say toast them in the pan until golden brown or dark golden brown? You just got a look of consternation on your face, Chris.
We could loop in our recipe editor, Liesl Davis, or Jonathan.
This is like
Milder.
A five-hour conversation at BA, probably.
Yeah, it's like golden. Ooh, it's like golden, you're in one space, but like dark golden is almost like a contradiction in terms. Like you've moved outside of the golden space, and yet.
Hello, parents, homeschoolers, and teachers. Trusty narrator here from the Who Smarted podcast. Our 15-minute episodes are perfect for car rides, bedtime, break time, class time, or any time. We make learning science and history fun and funny for 7 to 11-year-olds with new episodes every week. Look for Who Smarted on any podcast platform or at whosmarted.com. And teachers get a free subscription to our ad-free version by clicking Educators at whosmarted.com.